I'm Matthew Petty, and this is Intersection. This week marks the 28th anniversary of the Challenger disaster, when the space shuttle exploded 73 seconds after lifting off. Hugh Harris was the Director of Public Affairs for the Kennedy Space Center. He was known as the voice of the Kennedy Space Center for his job announcing the countdown and launches of the shuttles. I will speak with him about that day and his vision for the future of spaceflight. Also this week, the city of Eatonville is celebrating the life and legacy of author and folklorist Zora Neale Hurston. I will speak with N.Y. Nathiri, Executive Director of the Zora Neale Hurston Museum of Fine Arts in Eatonville, about Hurston's impact on Central Florida and what the historic town is doing to preserve its culture. That's ahead on Intersection. I'm joined in the studio by Hugh Harris. Hugh Harris is the former director of the Public Affairs Office at NASA's Kennedy Space Center, and he's also known as the voice of NASA and launch control. His book, Challenger, An American Tragedy, looks back at his time in the Public Affairs Office during the Space Shuttle Challenger disaster in 1986. Hugh, thank you very much for coming in.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Well, this week marks the 28th anniversary of the Space Shuttle Challenger disaster, when it broke apart just 73 seconds after liftoff. And I'm sure everybody who was around has some experience and recollection of that disaster and for what was really a tragedy that affected the entire country. Now, you were serving as the Chief of Public Information at the Kennedy Space Center at the time. Walk me through the day. How routine was that particular shuttle launch?
Well, we thought it was going to be fairly routine, except for the cold weather. And it was the coldest that I've ever experienced in Florida, certainly up to that time. Mm-hmm. When you say routine, actually, the news media, for instance, and the general public were thinking of it as just another shuttle launch. We were up to, we'd had 24 successful launches. And so the press actually turned up in fairly small numbers. And only one of the networks was actually broadcasting it live. Personally, did not think that it was going to go because of the cold weather. Every time I checked with the people in the firing room, they were saying, you know, that's the thing that we're most concerned about. So when I got there into the firing room about 4 or 5 hours before launch, that was what was talked about mostly on the operational intercom system. But it was something that each group of engineers really had to assess for themselves. And the only objection that was brought up, and it was brought up by Rockwell, was that possibly ice that had formed on the pad would fall during launch and damage the protection system for the orbiter so that it could have a problem during reentry. After a lot of mathematical calculations, it was decided that wasn't a problem. And every single person in the chain of the people who say that they're either ready to go or not ready to go, said go. Mm-hmm. And the launch director, Gene Thomas, really didn't have a whole lot of latitude. He could have said, well, I don't think that's right and we're not going to go. But when everybody else, who are the experts in each of the systems, say go, then, you know, he said, you know, we're ready to launch, and we went ahead with it.
Right. So it was the cold that caused the problem, as was discovered in the aftermath and the investigation. The O-ring seal and the solid rocket booster malfunctioned, but it wasn't cold in the way that some of the engineers had thought might cause a problem on the launch pad.
Right. Yeah. The cold on the launch pad, as it turned out, was not as serious. The O-ring is basically a seal. It's sort of like the rubber that you might have around your door so that when you close the door, air can't get out or in. And in this case, what shouldn't get out or in is the fire and all of the pressure that's in the solid rocket booster. And there's even a backup system, so there's two O-rings. And in the past, there had been some breach of the primary one, or the one that was closest to where the solid propellants were burning, but it had the flames had never gotten through that the second one. Hot gases had gotten through the first one, and in a couple of instances there had been some what they called sooting, which would indicate that some hot gases had escaped through the second one also. Mm-hmm. It wasn't that the engineers who were responsible for the solid rocket boosters were completely oblivious to that. They knew that was happening. They had recommended that it needed to be fixed. And there was even committees that were supposed to be redesigning it. But one of the things that happens in life, and this is in all aspects of life, is if you do something successfully and get away with it, even though there was some danger signs there, you tend to say, well, it worked last time, therefore it will work this time. That wasn't the case with Challenger.
So what happened right after that point? So you've done the countdown, you've sent the shuttle off, but when disaster strikes some 70 seconds into the flight, you're not actually commentating at that point, but you're watching things unfold. What's going through your mind at that point?
NASA operates in a way where there are plans for what to do when things are successful and what to do when things go wrong. And there were contingency plans both for the technical people and for public affairs if there should be an accident. And in some cases, we even had written out the announcements that we would give in the case of accidents. And what was sort of interesting is that we had, people are very human, and the person I talked to, who was responsible for a lot of the video, and said, that they needed to be copying things because the guards would be there. He ran around and locked all the doors up to the studio area.
Wait, this is to keep the guards out?
That's to keep the guards out so that we can finish copying the tapes. Not thinking at the time that the guards all have master keys so that they can get in. But that's a sidelight, because the people who really had the job over there were already copying them. Mm-hmm. And we were able to preserve enough of them for the media to continue into business pretty much.
The days that followed, what was your role coordinating with the media? And I guess, did you have a role with the families of the astronauts as well in the days and weeks that followed?
Well, in the public affairs office, I didn't personally. I was involved with the media. Other parts of public affairs immediately took the families to a big auditorium that we had, a training auditorium, so that they could be in one place and protected from all of the other visitors. The wives or husbands, in one case, were taken to the crew quarters, so that they would be in a position where we could give them whatever the information was that was available.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm speaking with Hugh Harris. He's the former director of the Public Affairs Office at NASA's Kennedy Space Center, known as the voice of NASA and launch control. His book, Challenger, An American Tragedy, looks back on his time in the Public Affairs Office during the Space Shuttle Challenger disaster in 1986. You can join the conversation online, send us a tweet, or on Facebook. You can also send us an email, intersection@wmfe.org. Things have changed quite dramatically, haven't they, from when you were working with NASA to now the Orion spacecraft that's in construction out at the Kennedy Space Center, the Space Launch System, a ginormous rocket, a huge rocket that's bigger than anything ever built before. Mm-hmm. And there's also that fragmentation. There's private companies that are working on smaller spacecraft to send U.S. astronauts from U.S. soil once again back to low Earth orbit. So things have changed quite somewhat from when the shuttle program was in operation and before that the Apollo program too.
That's true, but the philosophy really hasn't changed that much. NASA, if you trace the history of NASA, its forerunner was NACA, which was the National Advisory Committee on Aeronautics, that goes way back to about 1916. When the United States was behind the rest of the world in aeronautics. And that seems, surprising from the standpoint that the first powered flight took place here in the United States with the Wright brothers.
Well, there's some argument on that. In fact,
well, yes, there
some,
is.
Some folks in New Zealand suggested that actually happened in New Zealand, but yes.
When that organization was started by the government, it was to provide for research and development that was not economically sound for private industry to do. And then private industry, which would be involved in it, and they were, could use that technology to do something that was profitable and wasn't costing the taxpayer money. The same thing has happened in the case of SpaceX and Orbital Sciences and some of the other companies today, where the technology that was developed for going into Earth orbit has now been taken by them at a point where it's fairly well developed, and they are able to now take over at a cheaper price than we were able to do earlier while we were still developing it, and fly into Earth orbit. And I expect that they'll be flying astronauts in the fairly near future. That leaves NASA able to concentrate on what is the next step and to do the harder things. And that's really the job that NASA has, is to do the things that we have thought once impossible.
Hugh Harris, do you think that's a good way to go? Do you feel like NASA is heading on the right track with that, leaving some of space flight to private companies like SpaceX, like Blue Origin, et cetera, and concentrating on deep space exploration?
Oh, absolutely. I think that that is the right way to go. It's very important that this country be doing that. And when you look at, what SpaceX and Blue Origin and Orbital Sciences are doing, that isn't being done anyplace else in the world. And they are able to reduce costs and probably take back business from the government-subsidized launch vehicles that are that much of the commercial traffic to space had taken over.
Mm-hmm. Is the Challenger disaster the event that sticks in your mind the most out of your time working in NASA Public Affairs?
I suspect that it certainly does from the standpoint of crises that have happened. But watching the growth of knowledge over the years is probably the most satisfying part of it.
Mm-hmm. I've been speaking to Hugh Harris. He's the former director of public affairs at NASA's Kennedy Space Center, and he's known as the voice of NASA and launch control. His ebook, Challenger, An American Tragedy, looks back on his time in the public affairs office during the Space Shuttle Challenger disaster in 1986. Hugh Harris, thank you very much for coming in and speaking with me.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
Up next, a conversation with N.Y. Nethiri about Zora Neale Hurston's impact on the town of Eatonville. I'm joined in the studio by N.Y. Nethiri. N.Y. is with the Association to Preserve the Eatonville Community. She's also the Executive Director of the Zora Neale Hurston Museum of Fine Arts in Eatonville. N.Y., thank you very much for joining me.
Pleasure to be here.
Well, let's talk a little bit about Zora Festival, because this is the 25th anniversary of the festival. Yeah. Looking back over the last quarter century, how has the festival grown?
Well, when you say looking back over the last quarter century, that in itself is a little bit, I won't say off-putting, but it really is something that makes you pause. Because when we began in 1990, though we saw this as an annual event, honestly, we could not have projected how this festival has not only grown, but its impact locally, regionally, and nationally, and increasingly internationally. I think it's in part because the goals of the festival are timeless. They don't have a limit. By that, I mean the celebration of the life and work of Zora Neale Hurston, the writer, the anthropologist, the folklorist, the celebration of the historic significance of Eatonville as our country's oldest incorporated African-American municipality, and the celebration of the cultural contributions which people of African ancestry have made to the United States and to the world. It really allows us each cycle of 5 years to explore, to explicate, to really help inform ourselves and the public about what this event represents.
Now, Zora Neale Hurston, of course, is a literary figure of huge magnitude, and this is not the only festival celebrating her life and achievements, but is this the most well-known one?
I would say that this is the, shall we say, in terms of matriarchy, we are the grandmother. We are the great-grandmother of the festivals. We are really the one that started in 1990. Mm-hmm. There are others that occur, one in the state and maybe elsewhere. But there is no doubt that in terms of the quality, the commitment to scholarship, the commitment to fine public programming, the commitment to bringing the creme de la creme of arts and humanities offerings, that this is the festival that I would say has that distinction worldwide.
Now, if you were to explain Zora Neale Hurston to somebody who's an outsider to Florida and Central Florida, how would you sum up the impact she had on Eatonville and on Central Florida overall?
Well, I would say that if we were going to look at Eatonville, there's no doubt that Zora Neale Hurston has helped to preserve intact the historic significance of that community. In 1987, the Orange County Board of County Commissioners took a legislative action that would have, without any doubt, destroyed the historic character of Eatonville. So that if you look at the impact on Eatonville, some of our colleagues in the field of preservation say that Zora Neale Hurston actually saved Eatonville. Mm-hmm.
And you're talking about the plan to build a road.
That's right.
The plan through the town.
To expand the two-lane highway that runs from Wymore Road east to 1792, Kennedy Boulevard in Eatonville, Lake Avenue in Maitland. Mm-hmm. That was on the books for a road improvement project. And honestly, I would say that the decision makers of Orange County did not understand Eatonville in the way that it is seen as a literary destination, as established by Zora Neale Hurston. So there was a lack of information, and from that lack of information, there was bad public policy. Mm-hmm. To the credit of Orange County, what we were able to do was to really inform decision makers, let people know, frankly, that from a technical point of view, there was no rationale or no justification, really, for that kind of road improvement project. So from the very let's say, local perspective of the community of Eatonville, Zora Neale Hurston has been a savior.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 WMFE-FM. I'm Matthew Petty. You can join the conversation online on Facebook or Twitter. You can also send us an email, intersection@wmfe.org. When you talk about preserving a community, I'm wondering if there's some kind of balance you have to strike between preservation and nurturing it so that it's a growing thing and not just preserved in amber. Like, how do you do
that? That's right. It's not, and it's preserving in this instance, and you really have hit upon an important point. It's not about trying to make something remain staid and narrow and something that's a creature of the past. In fact, preservation is dynamic, and the only way you can preserve a community like Eatonville is to have it develop its natural resources. And in this instance, the natural resources are literature, culture, heritage. It's actually about what is, I don't want to say spiritual in a religious sense, but it's something that has to do, it's about thought, it's about ideas, it's about the intellect and about creativity. Our challenge, and one of the reasons why we are launching the Zora STEM Project, is because in order to really preserve the Eatonville community, its children have to be able to compete globally. Mm-hmm. That means they must be able to assume the well-paying jobs of the 21st century.
When you talk about the natural resources that a town has, aside from the cultural heritage, the intellectual resources of the Zora Festival, I know that Eatonville is also putting some effort into building up its, you know, physical resources too. Like, we've had Mayor Bruce Mount on the program talking about the walking initiative.
Yes.
Plans to roll out more sidewalks and things like mm-hmm. that. I'm just wondering, how much of a change have you seen? How much more is there still to be done with Eatonville to make it a really good, livable city?
Well, I would say, and this is probably because I am a student of history, I would say that Eatonville would serve itself well to employ some of the traditions of the past, because when you talk about healthy community, for example, we have as a part of our year-round programming something that we call the Yards and Gardens of Historic Eatonville, and I must admit that I didn't realize that what we are doing in Eatonville was so special, because it's what people do ordinarily. And in other words, I want to be very specific about this. I didn't realize that when you go to the farmer's market, that what you get at the farmer's market is produce that someone has gone to like a wholesaler. It's not necessarily organic.
Sure.
It's not necessarily grown locally. You know, I'm thinking about what happens in Eatonville, where it's all organic. Mm-hmm. It's not a big deal. I mean, that's just what it is. You know, the people, they may use cow manure or rabbit manure, but the point is, everything, it's grown organically.
So you're saying there's still a pretty strong tradition in Eatonville?
Oh, absolutely.
People growing their own vegetables?
Oh, absolutely. We have a group of men and women who meet monthly that have been meeting for the last 3 or 4 years. Now, they are meeting monthly, but it wouldn't matter whether we were meeting monthly or not, because they would be growing their produce. We simply put a structure around it.
What about the demographics of Eatonville? Is there, I don't know, a lot of older cities have a problem where younger folks leave to go somewhere where there are better opportunities. Is Eatonville facing those same problems?
I would say that there is a challenge, at least down the road. What we're seeing now is that people who left Eatonville to make a living or to establish a career, they're now coming back in their retiring years. It's almost as if any of your listeners are familiar with people who have worked in the United States and they go back to Ireland, or they go back to Italy, or they maintain mm-hmm. a dual kind of presence. We have been seeing over the last decade or more that kind of situation where people have worked in California, they've worked in New York, then they're coming back home, and their homestead is there. What we see as a challenge, let's say 20 years or now, 30 years from now, is that if we do not make certain that the young people can work outside and sleep in Eatonville, because Eatonville has always been a bedroom community, that we will see a demise of the town, mm-hmm. because you will not have people who are able to stay. Right now, I would say probably for the next couple of decades, we're all right, because even though the population may be older, there's a commitment there. What we have to look at is those young people who are basically now starting from first grade. What's going to happen with them when they graduate from high school? Can they stay in Eatonville, work in Orlando, work in different places, but know that they can make a good living so that they can stay in the town?
What are some of the solutions to that? Do you think it's public transportation, making sure that there are good connections from Eatonville to other thriving
cities?
Well,
I would say the ultimate solution really is education. I mean, sometimes people, you know, talk about education. It almost sounds like pablum or some sort of palliative. But when you really get down to it, it's whether you know that 7 times 7 is 49, and what does that mean with isosceles triangle, and what that means with biology. I mean, it's really a very straight connection between the ability to do well in school and the ability to get a well-paying job.
Mm-hmm. Let me just circle back to Zora Neale Hurston. I mean, you talk about some people see the Saturday Outdoor Festival as the festival itself, and they don't think about all the other things going on throughout the week. What about people showing up to that festival on the Saturday? How many of them would you say have read some of her works, like Their Eyes Were Watching God, for example? How many people are really aware of her literary impact and that importance?
I would say that a thin sliver, frankly, on Saturday, because it is a different, it is a festival of arts, and you don't really, what we are teaching comes in a nuanced way. It would be different if you were coming on Education Day, or if you were coming to some of the public talks where there is actually a topic that helps you to put her in context. Our commitment to the Outdoor Festival is to try to help people understand the importance of culture in a practical way. I would say that the Friday evening program, An Evening with Zora, where we're featuring Lynn Whitfield and Avery Brooks, will be an excellent opportunity to hear Zora Neale Hurston in her own words. Now, of course, all of this information you can find online at www.zorafestival.org, or you can call the museum 407-647-3307, or you can go to the library or any number of places and pick up a copy of the official guide where all of this is laid out. But I would say that as we proceed in the week, there are substantially more opportunities to, again, find out about Zora Neale Hurston, to find out about the historic Eatonville community, and to find out about the cultural contributions which people of African ancestry have made to the United States, mm-hmm. and to world culture.
I've been speaking to NY Natheri. She is with the Association to Preserve Eatonville. She's also the executive director of the Zora Neale Hurston Museum of Fine Arts in Eatonville. We've been talking about Zora Festival. Thank you very much for joining me, NY.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
The conversation about what's happening in Florida continues online at wmfe.org/intersection. There you can also sign up for our weekly podcast. Support for Intersection comes from our listeners. Brendan Byrne is assistant producer. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.